American businesses need more skilled workers. How do we find the talent? How do we go about developing it? And how do we create opportunities for everyone in our society to get a good job? You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation, a nonprofit media company telling stories about the future of work, the future of education, and closing the job skills gap. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace. We talk with innovators, educators, decision makers, people with ideas and solutions for today's workforce challenges. On today's program, the hidden figures in our unemployment numbers.
There are about 6.5 million workers who are officially counted as unemployed. That does not count the tens of millions of women and men who don't make enough living to be secure in their livelihood on behalf of their families.
Leo Henry is chairman and CEO of Trine Acquisitions and the former president and CEO of AT&T Broadband. Each month, for more than a decade, he's released his own analysis of the state of the nation's workforce, which he calls the Real Unemployment Report. It's based on the report released each month by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, but Henry's version cites details that almost always go unmentioned in headlines, details about how the worker is faring. More on the numbers in a moment. But first, we discuss the makeup of today's workforce.
The underpinnings of what is work have been changed. We only have about 8.5% of women and men in manufacturing today. When we came out of the Second World War, those figures were roughly 50-50. 50% of the women and men were in the services categories, and 50% made things. And we've just perpetually eroded the latter. A manufacturing job, of which I've held many. I worked my way through college by working in a shipyard at night. I'd spent some time in the merchant marine. I was very good with my hands. The jobs that I enjoyed and advanced me in my life don't exist anymore. The shipyard that I worked for in Seattle, Washington is no more. And we have to be very, very concerned about matching skills of the half of the population who would find those manufacturing jobs as they once did to be the best of all possible opportunities with the reality that we've eroded the category so dramatically.
You know, one of the things that we've looked into and saw some solutions where companies, I'm going to give the example Toyota, where they work with the local community college and then they work with the local community leaders to create training programs to get the people in their community upskilled to the higher tech version of that manufacturing. I don't understand, and maybe you have a thought on it, why that's not happening all over the place.
Well, it's no surprise that the example you use is Toyota, which evidences the ethos of Japan, where respect for the lifetime employment of your workers is a prerequisite to senior management. When we came out of the Second World War, and really until the Reagan administration, corporate responsibility paid as much attention to employees, to communities, to customers, and to the nation as it did to shareholders. And Milton Friedman in 1970 tried to persuade the nation that only shareholder wealth accumulation mattered. And he was essentially laughed off the stage. That said, by 1997, very formally, what's called the Business Roundtable said that only shareholder accumulation was the criteria on which you should measure your corporate responsibility. The Japanese don't feel that way. The Japanese have a womb to tomb sense of their employees, whether they stay with the actual company. They're sensitive to where the woman or man goes next. They're worried about their retirement security. And it manifests itself most notably in the fact that wages for the most senior women and men in Japan are multiples, reasonable multiples of the average employee. Here, it's not surprising that something on the order of 200 times the average employee's wage is the wage of the women and men who run the largest companies in the United States, the 181 large companies that impact our society and our economy so much. And it's disappointing that it's Toyota that does it. Not because I'm disappointed they're doing it, I'm disappointed that others aren't.
Have you seen any American companies that have embraced any model like that that you think is like on the right track?
I don't see it so absolutely in our manufacturing companies. I really don't. I seen if I would feel differently if we hadn't offshored millions of jobs to Mexico, to China. Offshoring is an acknowledgement or an admission on your part that you can do it more cheaply elsewhere. And more cheaply simply means paying lesser salaries to the women and men who work for you. I do find that there are some in the service sector. Jamie Dimon at JP Morgan Chase, I think, has an exceptional sense of responsibility to the whole of his workforce. But my concern with that is I don't want to find that degree of sensitivity only in the services sector. We have to get back to ennobling and growing dramatically our manufacturing sector.
And now talking about underemployed people, you know, when I look at the numbers, I see, you know, people working part-time because they can't find full-time jobs, people working multiple jobs, people, again, not skilled up, even if they only have one job, not skilled up to be able to make a middle-class wage. Do you have any ideas on how do we solve that problem?
There's two or three things going on here. Let's go back to 1947. When we came out of the war, the official unemployment rate and the real unemployment rate were roughly the same. We counted everybody. Now, we set up mechanisms to try not to count everybody, but in fact, most everybody coming out of the war, given the vitality of the post-war economy, had employment. They were fairly compensated. They had employment. It was a kind of a magical time, the 50s, in the United States in terms of balance and fairness. As we began to erode our manufacturing base, we left behind millions of workers who saw their jobs either being offshored to foreign jurisdictions or just cut back and eliminated in their entirety. There's sort of three categories of the uncounted. There's the marginally attached. This is a woman or man who is looking for work, can't find it, but still works very hard at trying to find it. There's the discouraged woman or man who would love a job, now just simply admits they can't find one. They're so discouraged that they don't look very hard. They're not like the marginally attached. And then there's the part-time of necessity. And the key phrase there is of necessity. They have a part-time job, not because they want one. It's because they can't find a full-time one. No woman or man in those three categories is getting any benefits, particularly the part-time of necessity employee. Certainly is not getting health care, retirement security, any of the benefits that a full-time worker might have. And again, there are about 6.5 million workers who are officially counted as unemployed. There's roughly twice that many who are, in real terms, unemployed. That does not count the tens of millions of women and men who don't make enough living to be secure in their livelihood on behalf of their families.
And then the BLS has their number of open jobs every month as well. And we have 7.3 million approximately for the last couple of months of open jobs. We have over 6 million unemployed people, but there's a big mismatch between skills and openings.
Well, the mismatch in part is the fact that it's 3,000 miles from Los Angeles to New York and back again. Just because there's a job opening in Los Angeles doesn't mean that the woman or man who lives in Topeka, Kansas has the wherewithal to pursue that job. So when you take a country as physically large as ours, built on diversity and built on great immigration histories with English often as the second language, where the BLS will let you down is they'll say these jobs are available, but they're not realistic about sort of saying how might they be filled. So when I say there's a real unemployment problem, often I'll get pushback from people who say, well, it's not a problem. Look at these job openings.
But if they can't match, and you're right, geography is important.
Geography is profoundly important. Skill levels profoundly important. Cost of living differentials, language skills. And so whatever we do in the into the future, we have to advance our manufacturing employment to match the changes in technology, in society, that are immutable. They're coming. And there are going to be situations where the job openings, as officially defined, are actually going to creep higher than the official unemployment number. What happened as well was home ownership became a trait of our society. If you own a home in Des Moines, Iowa, that's worth $20,000, $30,000, and you're being asked to move to Los Angeles, where a home is mid to high six figures, you can't move. So don't blame the woman or man who doesn't move. Look at the underpinnings and see why they might be hesitant to move. Their children are in school. That's a disruptor. Their house may not be as worth as much, or if they can even sell it in a distressed middle market environment, may not even be worth but a fraction of the house they would have to acquire in the new marketplace. And this isn't Liechtenstein. This isn't a country that's so small that it fits on a postage stamp and everybody is in services. We have half of the nation's population, 56% precisely, that has an IQ on the range of 100. We have to be hypersensitive to their work aspirations and find them employment that meets their enjoyment expectations, their compensation expectations, and their health expectations.
We're speaking with Leo Hendry, former CEO of AT&T Broadband. This is Work in Progress, and I'm Ramona Schindelheim. When we come back, the internet as a civil rights issue.
Civil rights traditionally has been about race and ethnicity and gender and faith and orientation. It needs to also include this technical phenomenon called the internet.
The future of work is changing. Are you ready? If you're not yet familiar with Working Nation, let me tell you a little about us. We're a nonprofit media company made up of seasoned journalists, producers, business leaders, and educators. Our mission is to bring awareness to the impact changing technology is having on the workforce. A lot of people are talking about the problem. At Working Nation, we're focused on solutions. We're looking at the programs that are out there, and we're talking to the people who are working to close the skills gap, the gap between the skills employers need in a workforce and the skills workers actually have. We do this through Working Nation videos, articles, live events, and of course, podcasts. All of these and more can be found on our website, workingnation.com, your source for all information on the future of work. My guest, Leo Hendry, has long been a recognized leader in the media industry. From his founding of Intermedia Partners to heading up TCI, AT&T Broadband, and the YES Network. But Hendry sees the internet as more than just a delivery system for sitcoms and Yankees games. In his mind, it's a human right.
It's a large part of my career path is broadband for everyone, but particularly because the better schools have inherent broadband. The lesser funded schools and the homes of the children that go to those schools have neither. You have to take the technology where the gaps are. And I am very concerned as I look at employment here in the country today. We have these pockets in the East and pockets in the West and this desert, so to speak, of employment in the middle.
Yeah, there's a couple of initiatives and programs that I've spoken with people about in this skills gap issue. And it's about how if you could bring broadband to one of those rural communities or a smaller community, you could have people working remotely. They could be doing these tech consulting jobs from their home, still, you know, be able to own their home and still be able to live in their community.
The other thing that it would do is it would better inform society. The internet is not just an entertainment mechanism, a fun and games environment. Its primary opportunity is to educate and inform the society, to advance distant medicine, to improve the quality of our educational facilities. And if I bring broadband to the rural or semi-rural communities, that family that suddenly has broadband is ideally better informed. Their children are better educated. Their health care is better. Their sense of opportunity for employment outside of that small town is elevated. What you have to do is immediately acknowledge the history of the internet. It was birthed as an academic phenomenon, became a national security capability, and today is in most people's minds thought to be some grand entertainment or gaming phenomenon. If it's the latter, I am not so concerned about who has or who doesn't have broadband. If the reality of broadband is education, health care, job advancement, job alteration to meet the changing environment and the changing economy, then every family that you leave behind is decimated into the future. And we do have a country that's 3,000 miles in width. And what we've created is almost a redlined sense of the internet. In certain of our urban communities already, poor children don't have access that rich children do. But we compound that by large parts of the United States, the rural or the semi-rural cities, not having the same as well. So it's both geographic and locale that's impinging on full distribution of broadband.
What do you think needs to be done to be able to get it, if not full, everybody has it, but the majority of the country to have it?
Everybody who purveys broadband in one form or another is reliant on the federal government for something, a license, loan guarantees, things of that sort. There's all kinds of opportunity for the Federal Communications Commission under its public interest doctrines to require purveyors of broadband to leave nobody behind. It's a civil rights issue that should be paramount. And it'll be the first technological issue that is a civil rights issue. Civil rights traditionally has been about race and ethnicity and gender and faith and orientation. It needs to also include this technical phenomenon called the internet. We're hearing in the presidential debates that healthcare is a human right. I believe that. Access to the technology called the internet is a human right. And it's a human right in Africa, Latin America, United States, Asia. You will profoundly leave behind any young woman or man who doesn't have access to the internet at an early age.
You know, I never really thought about it in that term, but now that you said it, it makes sense, because I think everybody should have that opportunity. Because again, I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up 40 miles from Chicago, so I wasn't in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
But my mom and dad grew up in Arkansas, and there's parts of where they grew up, they
still
don't
today.
Have it.
Still
yeah,
today.
Still today. It's amazing. What made you get into broadband? What was your path in there? And what did you see happen as you were there growth-wise?
The media industry is about as fun as it gets because it's so impactful. If we had done nothing more than transform entertainment and information. So we gave you CNN, MSNBC, CNBC, Fox. If we had just stopped there, that would have been pretty magical. But the real value of the internet is academia. It's education, it's healthcare, it's distance learning, healthcare from distance. if I'm literate in the internet and you're illiterate, my career path is factors greater than yours. And that's the case even if I work on the floor at GM, because the robot age is highly technical. And so the internet's now, it is a sine qua non for me.
Work in Progress is produced by Working Nation, your source on the future of work. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, and we've been talking about the real unemployment numbers and broadband as a civil right with my guest, Leo Hendry. To find out more about the millions of underemployed workers and about how universal broadband can help level the playing field, visit workingnation.com. Next week, Pamela Redmond-Satran, author of the novel Younger, reveals the uncomfortable truth about re-entering the workforce in your 40s.
The more comfortable you can get with feeling uncomfortable, the better your life's going to be, because you will do a lot of things you might not otherwise do.
To hear more about the future of work and workers, subscribe to Work in Progress wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our producer, Annie Chelsea, and executive producers Joan Lynch and Melissa Panzer. Our theme music was composed by Lee Rossevere and licensed under Creative Commons Attribution License 4.0 International. See you next time.